Welcome back to Earth First Radio. This is the second half, and I'm Uncle Dennis. All right. We were doing animal news, so let's keep doing it. Thousands of elephant seals are returning from fall migrations for the winter birthing and breeding season at Año Nuevo, California, a major rookery for seals and sea lions 55 miles south of San Francisco. Sophisticated new satellite tracking technologies deployed by scientists at the University of California at Santa Cruz show how the animals spend their time at sea. The researchers, led by UCSC professors of biology Bernie LaBeouf and Dan Costa, have found striking differences between male and female elephant seals in their migration patterns and feeding strategies. The team tracked the daily movements of 47 elephant seals for months at sea during foraging trips. Satellite tracking devices and data recorders attached to 27 adult males and 20 adult females traced their migration routes and diving patterns with unprecedented accuracy. It appears that male and female elephant seals travel to different areas and feed on very different kinds of prey. Male elephant seals show consistency in their migrations, while females follow more variable routes pursuing prey that move about in the open ocean. We are able to monitor continuously the diving pattern of a seal, sea lion, or whale in minute detail for up to a year at sea, and we are learning unexpected things, LaBeouf said. Ironically, we know more about behavior at sea than about some behaviors on land. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has released a draft recovery plan for the endangered Peninsular Bighorn Sheep. The Peninsular Bighorn Sheep was listed as an endangered species in March of 1998 and has been protected in California since 1971. The Peninsular Bighorn Sheep occur about 500 miles of desert mountain ranges in the San Jacinto and Santa Rosa Mountains of California to the Vulcan Tres Virgenes Mountains of Mexico. The sheep population in the U.S. has declined by about 76% since 1971, from about 1,170 down to 335 individuals. The species no longer occurs in several historic locations. Habitat loss, predation, disturbance from recreational vehicles have all contributed to the decline of the Peninsular Bighorn Sheep throughout its range. Viral and bacterial diseases are also factors in the sharp decline of the species. The draft recovery plan aims to implement measures to protect habitat and lessen threats to the sheep. It could lead to their eventual removal from federal endangered species list. Comments on the plan are invited until February 14th. If you'd like to comment on the recovery plan or to request copies of the draft recovery plan, contact Field Supervisor, Carlsbad Fish and Wildlife Office, 2730 Loker Avenue, that's L-O-K-E-R Avenue, in West Carlsbad, California, 92008. Once again, that address is Field Supervisor, Carlsbad Fish and Wildlife Office, 2730 Loker Avenue, L-O-K-E-R, West Carlsbad, California, 92008. And be sure to comment on the Peninsular Bighorn Sheep Recovery Plan. From Corvallis, Oregon, a level of nitrogen-based compounds considered safe for human drinking water is apparently enough to kill some frogs. A new study at the Oregon State University published in the journal Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry shows that several frog and toad species are susceptible to low levels of nitrate and nitrite exposure. Moderate levels of the pollutants in amounts often found in agricultural areas as the result of crop fertilization caused reduction of feeding activity, physical abnormalities, paralysis, and death in some tadpoles and young frogs. I think this is clearly a significant problem, said Andrew Blostein, a professor of zoology at Oregon State University and an expert on global amphibian declines. Right here in the Pacific Northwest, we're having localized extinctions of some amphibians and widespread declines in others. We now have clear evidence that nitrite and nitrate exposure at levels considered safe for humans or fish is enough to kill amphibians. The OSU scientists worked on five species of amphibians, including the Oregon spotted frog, the red-legged frog, the western toad, Pacific tree frog, and the northwestern salamander. In the past 40 years, the Oregon spotted frog has disappeared from most of its known historical range in lowlands with intensive agricultural use. The Oregon spotted frog was the most sensitive to environmental levels of nitrates and nitrites, 3 to 4 times more vulnerable than red-legged frogs and Pacific tree frogs. Levels of nitrite considered safe for human drinking water killed over half the Oregon spotted frog tadpoles after only 15 days of exposure. All five species showed a similar number of deaths at level of nitrites that were higher, but still well below those the EPA considers safe for warm water fishes. The study indicates the EPA water quality criteria does not guarantee the survival of some protected and endangered amphibians, according to the authors. And we've got a new millennium bug. Well, it's one that can't be found in computers anyway. The newly discovered insect is to be formally named the millennium bug, and it belongs to a new genus of the family Velidiae, a small water strider. Insect scientists often use water striders to monitor the quality of fresh water. Okay, I think I already read that one. Government biologists are reviewing the status of the Sacramento Mountains checker spot butterfly, a species known to exist only in one small area of New Mexico, to determine whether it should be proposed for listing as an endangered or threatened species. The Southwest Center for Biological Diversity filed a petition with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in January of 1999 asking for an endangered listing, and under the Endangered Species Act, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is required to review petitions to decide whether they contain substantial information supporting a full review of the species. The determination to conduct a full review is the first step in the process, said Nancy Kaufman, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Regional Director of the Southwest Region. We found the petition contains enough information to warrant more comprehensive look at the species. Our review will include all available information, not just what was in the petition, including information submitted by other government agencies, scientists, and the public. Threats to the species include proposed land transfers between the U.S. Forest Service and the village of Cloudcroft, a residential development, invasive plants overgrazing by livestock, and global climate change. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is inviting public comment to provide any additional scientific information on the species or its habitat. Once the review is completed, the public will have an opportunity to comment on that proposal, and hopefully we'll have that information for you. That is the Sacramento Mountains checker spot butterfly. And sea lions died along the California coast in the spring at the same time an algae bloom was observed in Monterey Bay. The algae carried domoic acid, a potent toxin that attacks the brain. An examination of the animals showed the effects of domoic acid in their brains. Christopher Scholin of the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute reported in last Thursday's issue of the journal Nature. Scholin said the sea lions had eaten large quantities of anchovies, a small fish that fed on the algae. The study marked a rare opportunity to track an outbreak of the poisonous algae through the food chain. It's the first time it's been shown, and it's shown a very sound and convincing way, said Stephen Bates of the Gulf Fisheries Center at the Fisheries and Oceans Canada in Moncton, New Brunswick. About 70 sea lions survived the initial outbreak, but showed symptoms of domoic acid poisoning, including head waving, depression, and abnormal scratching. All but about 20 of those sea lions eventually died. The same kind of algae caused a die-off of cormorants, a kind of a pelican, in 1991 in California. A related algae sickened people and killed marine life on Prince Edward Island in Canada in 1987. And federal agencies involved in the regulating the Yellowstone National Park bison herd are moving to complete an environmental impact statement on the management of that herd. Because negotiations with the state of Montana have reached an impasse, government officials have decided to move forward on their own to complete the environmental impact statement and take other steps to protect cattle and minimize the lethal control of bison. Ranchers fearing their cattle could be infected with brucellosis, a disease common to both cattle and bison that causes pregnant animals to abort, have routinely shot bison that strayed outside the park boundaries in winter. We all agree that protecting Montana cattle is crucial, but we believe significant adjustments can be made to the current bison test and slaughter policy, said Michael Dunn, Undersecretary of Agriculture. The agency proposal is designed to eventually eradicate brucellosis from the Yellowstone ecosystem through vaccinations. In the short term, the plan would separate bison and cattle by allowing bison outside of the park only in three limited areas. These zones would be buffered by additional areas into which no bison would be permitted. Cattle would be permitted back into the zones 45 days after bison have returned to the park in spring. The Brucella virus cannot survive on the ground for more than 17 days. We have spent countless hours combining the best science, experience, and practicality to protect both cattle and bison, said Don Berry, Assistant Secretary of the Interior. Unfortunately, we have reached an impasse with the state and feel we must move forward on our own. And Boise Cascade has announced a massive Cascadia logging project, which has spawned protests in Chile and the U.S., has been delayed, according to IPS News. The company stated that declining prices for plywood prompted the move to postpone groundbreaking on the project scheduled for this year. The suspension of the Cascadia project means renewed hopes for saving native forests by canceling the project, according to the Institute for Ecological Policy, one of the Chilean environmental groups opposed to the Cascadia project. We hope Chile's next government understands we cannot afford to lose 2.42 million trees from primary forests each year. If you'd like more information, contact Pat Rasmussen, American Lands Forest America's coordinator. His email address, patr@crcwnet. That's patr@crcwnet. And from Montreal, a decision released December 21st by the Honorable Jean-Jacques Croteau of the Quebec Superior Court has concluded the constitutional rights of the Cree Indians have been openly and continuously violated by the government of Quebec and the forestry companies. The court concluded that the Quebec forestry regime in the James Bay Territory is contrary to the provisions of the James Bay and the Northern Quebec Agreement and consequently is unconstitutional and inoperative. The court decided that the approval of general and five-year forest management plans submitted by the forestry companies must be subjected to full and complete assessments and evaluations of their environmental and social impacts on the Cree Indians as provided for under Chapter 22 of the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement. Forest activities must fully take into account the hunting, fishing, and trapping rights of the Cree Indians as provided for in the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement. The court held that the failure to submit forestry activities to full social and environmental assessment in order to take into account the rights of the Crees is barbarism. The court found the regime put into place by the Ministry of Forests of Quebec reflects a negligent attitude, among other reasons, because Quebec has delegated the powers to develop forest management plans to the forestry companies. The court added that this negligent attitude can also be seen by the public as an appearance of conflict of interest and thus throws discredit on the provincial administration. For the Grand Chief of the Crees, Dr. Ted Moses, this is an important decision and a decisive victory in the conflict which opposes the Crees, the Government of Quebec, and the forestry companies. The Crees have denounced the actions of the Government of Quebec in this matter for many years. The court has fully vindicated our position. The present forestry regime is squashed and must be immediately replaced by a new regime which takes into account our rights, declared Grand Chief Dr. Ted Moses. This is a great victory for the Crees, he says. Let us hope that the government of Quebec will take this opportunity and seize the occasion in order to end its irresponsible forest management system. If you'd like more information, you can contact Grand Chief Dr. Ted Moses, his number 514-232-3104. That's 514-232-3104 for Grand Chief of the Cree, Dr. Ted Moses. And I'd like to thank the Indigenous Environmental Network for providing this news. If you'd like to contact them, their email address is ien@igc.org. And from Paris, we read that Western Europe struggled to clear roads and railways and repair power lines after violent storms killed more than 50 people. Stranded train and plane passengers resumed their travels, and cleanup squads moved fallen trees and chimney rubble in northern and eastern France, where at least 33 people were reported dead. 1.5 million homes are without electricity, and folks are coming in from all over the place. In Germany, the freak storm killed at least 15. Some highways and many smaller roads are still blocked by trees after winds gusted to 180 kilometers per hour, just over 110 miles an hour. Never been anything like this. Obvious, because it was unique and exceptional. Freak winds. Nature has its own rules. This is a large article. I'm not going to read all of it. But what is the bottom line? The bottom line is the climate's changing, folks. One of the earliest and perhaps the easiest forecasts of the atmospheric oceanic overheating, also known as the greenhouse effect, is that it will bring an increase in the frequency and the violence of storms. It will also seem likely to bring a migration of tree species in a northward march, and the two will be related. Oh boy. In other climate news, the rising waters in Lake Chad following the heaviest rains in Central Africa for at least the last 30 years have left an estimated 25,000 people homeless in northern Nigeria. People were displaced from various areas in 7 local government councils following the resurgence of Lake Chad. Borno State's Housing and Environment Commissioner Ahmed Ashmi told reporters while calling on the central government for help. He said many of the victims have been lodged in schools, mosques, churches, and other public buildings. Lake Chad lies at the fringes of the Sahara Desert but is fed by rivers in tropical Central Africa. In previous years, environmentalists have issued warnings that it could dry up completely as a result of desertification because of overgrazing and possibly because of global warming. But locals reported the heaviest rains for 30 years. Floodwaters have also forced tens of thousands of people from homes in the Niger and the Benue River valleys and other parts of Africa's most populous nation this year. Other climate news. Temperatures in the United States will finish 1999 as the second warmest on record since 1900, only topped by 1998's all-time high mark, the National Oceanic and Administration said last week. NOAA said its projections show Americans will have experienced an average for 1999 of 55.7 degrees Fahrenheit. This follows 1998's record of 56.4 degrees. Temperatures for the last 2 years have followed in step with a long-term warming trend seen this century, with most of the warming occurring since the mid-1970s, according to NOAA. In addition to warmer temperatures, the agency said precipitation ebbed on the average, dropping an inch and 0.05 below normal levels to a projected 30.6 inches despite local heavy rainfall in the Pacific Northwest due to the La Nina weather pattern. Record dryness was also seen in the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, and Ohio valleys as a result of last summer's drought, and the April to July period was one of the driest or the second driest ever in all the states from West Virginia to Maine. Drought was followed by record rainfalls from the hurricanes Dennis and Floyd along the East Coast. NOAA also said records were also posted in equal number of unusual winter tornadoes last January. More than 70 tornadoes also occurred during a May outbreak, making 1999 the fourth busiest year for the tornadoes, with 1,225 reported. 94 people died as a result of tornadoes last year. NOAA also saw busier than normal hurricane season with 12 tropical storms, 8 that became hurricanes, and 5 of them were major. All right. And beginning in January 2000, you may see more U.S. Forest Service and contract employees working in national forest developed recreation sites and along Forest Service roads. They will be wearing bright orange vests and maybe near a sign that says Voluntary Recreation Use Survey Ahead. Just like the Postal Service, these people may be out in all kinds of adverse weather conditions. These people may ask to talk to you. What's this all about, you ask? The U.S. Forest Service lacks good information about visitors to federal lands. Some information that would be useful for forest and local community planning includes how many people actually recreate on federal lands and what activities they engage in while visiting. Other important information includes how satisfied people are with their visit and how much money they spent. This study will gather basic information. It's entirely voluntary and all responses are totally confidential. It takes about 6 minutes. Every other visitor is asked a few additional questions, which may take an additional 5 minutes. Information collected in this national study will be used in local forest planning at the state level and by Congress. If you have any questions about this study, contact the following website, www.fs.fed.us/recuse/shtml. And by the way, tell them you don't want to pay any fees, okay? Wildlands Center for Preventing Roads, the Wilderness Society, and more than 100 other organizations submitted a rulemaking petition in December asking the Forest Service to strengthen its regulations pertaining to the management of off-road vehicles. The use of ORVs in Forest Service lands is, in many cases, out of control, and the agency has been so far unable to or unwilling to do much about it. The improved regulations would clarify the Forest Service's duty to manage ORVs prudently and carefully, to ensure that natural values and non-motorized recreation are not adversely impaired, and that the use of ORVs is accompanied by fully funded monitoring and evaluation efforts. Specifically, the petition requested the following changes to the current ORV management framework: that motorized vehicles only be allowed on system roads and trails designed and posted as open for specific vehicle types. Cross-country travel would be prohibited. Designation of ORV routes only occur where the Forest Service can demonstrate that the use of the route by ORVs will not cause adverse environmental impacts. Designation of ORV routes, upgrading of existing routes to accommodate new or additional ORV use, and the construction or upgrading of facilities for ORV use must be fully analyzed under the National Environmental Policy Act. ORV use is to be prohibited unless adequate monitoring enforcement of its use and its impacts is fully implemented. That ORV use be prohibited legislatively or administratively in proposed wilderness areas, inventoried roadless areas, and other areas with roadless values, except on roads for which their use has been formally designated. The science and the law are clearly on our side. However, it is critical we make clear to the Forest Service that public opinion is on our side as well. Please send a letter to Forest Service Chief Dombeck supporting the rulemaking petition. Here's the address: Michael Dombeck, Chief U.S. Forest Service, 14th and Independence Avenue, Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20250. That address once again: Michael Dombeck, Chief U.S. Forest Service, 14th and Independence Avenue, Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20250. If you'd like more information, contact the Wildland Center for Preventing Roads. Their number, 406-543-9551. That's 406-543-9551. Or www.wildrockies.org/wildcpr. And Republican presidential candidate Senator John McCain said last week he would overturn all of President Bill Clinton's executive orders that set aside lands, including the order to preserve millions of acres of roadless forest lands, describing his own environmental agenda during a campaign stop near White Mountain National Forest in New Hampshire. The Arizona senator vowed to include more local input in land use decisions. The idea that Washington knows best and that local residents cannot be trusted to do what's right in their own backyard is the epitome of federal arrogance, said McCain. The existence of this very forest repudiates that offensive notion. The White Mountains National Forest exists not thanks to enlightened federal fiat or presumed superior foresight of the political class in Washington, he said. This forest was set aside nearly a century ago thanks to the vision and energy of local residents who demanded it. Washington would do well to keep the example in mind. McCain referred to former President Theodore Roosevelt as he promised to spend billions of dollars to improve national parks, fund federal research on environmental technologies, force federal agencies to obey environmental laws, and provide environmental monitoring and reporting to the public. What could be more conservative than conserving ourselves and for our posterity clean air, safe water, and the gifts of unspoiled creation, asked McCain. But what does that do about roadless areas? Well, unfortunately, that's about all the time I have for news right now. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzief@cruzio.com. That's cruzief@cruzio.com. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Please send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. That address, again, is Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. You can hear Earth First Radio live on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, every Thursday evening at 8 p.m. in Santa Cruz, California. Or you can listen to Earth First Radio on your computer on the World Wide Web. We're at radioforall.web.net. That's radio, the number four, all.web.net. You'll need a sound card in your computer, but the software you need is free at the website. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to broadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz and is affiliated with the Earth First Radio Network. Portions of this newscast were prepared with the help of Eon Blues. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And right now we're going to listen to Mariposa off their CD First Light of Dawn. And Let's see, I believe this one is called Across the Great Divide. It's a Kate Wolf tune.
Across the great divide.